Today is Tuesday, January 14th. We are working on hormone interactions, top of page 5. So last class period, we left off talking about these kinds of hormone interactions, and I promised we would revisit them today. So let me give you some examples. If we have a hormone like, say, thyroid-stimulating hormone that tells another gland to release a hormone like thyroxine, this is a type of interaction where one hormone tells another gland to release its hormones. Which of these three does that sound like? Good. It's hormonal stimulation. So it's kind of like a passing the buck. You know, I used the example in class on Thursday of mom yelling to a sibling to tell you to go clean your room instead of just telling you directly. It's kind of a relay mechanism to get that message to the ultimate gland, which in this case would be thyroid hormone. Let's do another one. When females undergo childbirth, a hormone called oxytocin is released from the brain, and that hormone is released by nerve endings. Which of these three does it sound like?
Neural
stimulation. Good. So when nerves release chemicals into the bloodstream, we call that neural stimulation. You may be thinking about, well, this kind of sounds like neurotransmitters, right? Neurotransmitters typically travel from one nerve to another cell, maybe another neighboring nerve cell. But anytime those hormones or chemicals get in the bloodstream, then we're technically going to say it's neural stimulation. And now those chemicals that are circulating are called hormones. So neurotransmitters are kind of like short-term communicators between cells, whereas hormones are long-term distance travel. They're going to go through your bloodstream throughout your body. Okay, so let's take the last one there, humoral stimulation. There are many types of minerals in your bodies that we must regulate, such as sodium, calcium, potassium, and so forth. If those levels change, maybe too high or too low, then there are glands that are responding to that by releasing hormones into the bloodstream. So if we're looking at changing levels of a chemical in the bloodstream like those minerals, then we often classify that as a humoral stimulus. So I want to point out here something that's easily confused. The word hormonal and humoral sound very similar. Just keep in mind that humor is not funny. It's meant to be the blood or the bodily fluids, and that's where that word comes from. So the humor is like blood. It means we're looking at blood concentration of certain ions or minerals, things of that sort. All right, do you feel like you have a little better grasp on those three types of stimulation? Okay, any questions on those before we keep moving? Just another way of review, last class period we talked about protein-based hormones and lipid-based hormones. Which one of those uses a secondary messenger system?
Protein-based,
good. And that's of course because they're too big, they can't cross through the plasma membrane. So where is the receptor for a protein hormone?
Outside,
right, sitting on that plasma membrane. What chemical inside the cell behaves as your second messenger?
CAMP.
Good. And to completely shift the tide over to lipid-based hormones, where is their receptor?
Intracellular.
Good. So that's inside the cell, and actually it's inside the nucleus. So those lipid-based hormones barge right in, they head to the nucleus and bind that intracellular receptor. That, by the way, is the blank for page 4, intracellular receptor. Just wanted to make sure you had that. Okay, so page 4 is blank near the bottom, intracellular receptor. All right, if you feel comfortable, let's move on to page 6 and talk about the hypothalamus. Okay, so hormone secretion is regulated to be within a narrow range of values. If you have too much, we will cut back on production. If you have too little, we will ramp up and increase production. This should sound like negative feedback because we're trying to maintain a narrow range of values for that hormone release. And that's how most hormones operate, is by a negative feedback system. There's only a very few that operate by positive feedback, and I'll point that one out when we get to it. So the hypothalamus is going to be our first major discussion into the hormones. And it's not necessarily a gland like you would expect with other types of endocrine glands, like, say, pituitary, for instance, but rather your hypothalamus is nervous tissue. And so you'll notice in this picture, the hypothalamus has a really close relationship with a nearby gland. What gland sits hanging from a stalk from the hypothalamus? Pituitary, good. Do you know the name of that stalk? Good, that is the infundibulum, good. And here's going way back. Do you remember the name of the bone that houses this pituitary gland?
Cellatursica,
it's part of the sphenoid bone, good. So sometimes people go to the eye doctor and may have problems with vision. Sometimes an eye doctor can actually sense, they can't directly see it, of course, because it's behind the eyes, but they can sense that there might be something pushing on the eye nerves, those optic nerves traveling back in the brain. If this pituitary gland begins to swell or hypertrophy, it can in fact cause problems with vision or the optic nerve. And for some people, that's part of a host of warning signs that there's something going on with that pituitary gland. So let's head back up to the hypothalamus right here and talk about its role. So the hypothalamus makes and releases two types of hormones that target a specific portion of your pituitary called the anterior pituitary. Those hormones are called releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones. Well, we're going to abbreviate them as RH for releasing hormones and IH for inhibiting hormones. So let me give you an example. If you're driving a car and you're trying to maintain a speed, let's say that the speed you're maintaining is 45 miles an hour. If you drop below that, then you're going to put on the gas pedal and speed up. That's what releasing hormones do. They say, hey, you're not putting out enough hormone, release more. So releasing hormones encourage more hormone production. What do you think inhibiting hormones tell the anterior pituitary to do?
Stop.
Right. So this is all about tweaking hormone release, making sure we're not releasing too much, making sure we're releasing just the right amount. So does this sound like negative feedback to you or positive? Yeah, sounds like negative, right? So it's a great way to maintain that just right amount of hormone production coming out of the anterior pituitary. So there is a blood portal system, not shown in this picture, but these hormones made up here by the hypothalamus actually do travel like a traditional hormone. They go over a blood portal system and they target this anterior pituitary tissue right down here. Okay. So I just want to make a point that the posterior pituitary has nervous tissue, while the anterior pituitary is actually made up of endocrine gland tissue. It's technically epithelial in nature, so it does release those hormones. We'll come back and talk about that difference in just a moment. Okay, so this is a partial list of hormones made by the hypothalamus. These hormones will target the anterior pituitary. I'll make it easy on you. They're all releasing hormones or inhibiting hormones on this list. Automatically, you know where they come from, right? Hypothalamus. And they're all targeting what portion of your pituitary?
Anterior.
Hey, how easy is that? You don't have to memorize anything. You just blanket say if you're a releasing hormone or if you're an inhibiting hormone, automatically know that they're made by the hypothalamus. And their target is going to be the anterior pituitary. All right, so this is a flashcard you may want to, you know, put down somewhere. Releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones. They are made by the hypothalamus. And they will target the anterior pituitary. So now you don't have to memorize the list. You can simply say, hey, I spot an RH as part of that name. I automatically know it's coming from the hypothalamus, and it's going right next door to the pituitary, telling it to make and release something. What would an inhibiting hormone come from the hypothalamus to tell the anterior pituitary?
Stop making it,
right. So it's like a gas pedal and a brake pedal. Either you increase through the releasing hormones or you decrease production at the anterior pituitary through those inhibiting hormones. All right, anyone still need this slide? So we're going to talk about these releasing and inhibiting hormones as we work through some anterior pituitary hormones and what they produce and what they do. We're going to tie that all together in the conversation. Okay, I do want to mention that the hypothalamus also makes a completely separate set of hormones, and they are called oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone. We'll talk about those in just a moment. They are neither releasing nor inhibiting. They're totally different from these releasing and inhibiting hormones that target your anterior pituitary. In fact, you'll notice these hormones, oxytocin and ADH, they're actually going to go and be stored where in the pituitary?
Posterior.
Yeah, posterior portion. And so they're released from the posterior pituitary. We'll come back and talk about those in just a moment. Okay, so let's review. The hypothalamus is nervous tissue. It makes a set of hormones called releasing and inhibiting hormones. What do these hormones target?
Anterior
pituitary. So the message is either make more of this or stop making it, right? So it's either a message to increase hormone production in the anterior pituitary, or it's a message to decrease production in the anterior pituitary. Totally separate are these two over here, oxytocin and ADH. Those two hormones are actually made by your hypothalamus, but they're stored and released in what portion of your pituitary?
Posterior,
right. So we'll come back and talk about those in just a moment. Okay, so we're now going to talk about the pituitary gland for just a moment. We know it has a really close relationship with your hypothalamus. We also know there's two portions to your pituitary. What are those two portions? Good, anterior and posterior. Do you know which one is the target of releasing and inhibiting hormones?
Anterior,
good. And where do those releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones come from? Good, right next door in the hypothalamus. And the posterior pituitary is made up of what type of tissue? Nervous tissue, right? So it receives two hormones for storage from the hypothalamus. What are they?
ADH.
Yeah, ADH and oxytocin. Good. So just to clarify, the anterior pituitary is made up of endocrine tissue. Hey, it's technically epithelial in nature. And the posterior pituitary is made up of nervous tissue. Let me take you way back to Bio-210 for just a moment. In Bio-210, you probably learned about tissues that heal quickly versus those that are poor to heal, slow to heal, may never heal. What type of tissue of these two heals quickly?
The
anterior epithelial tissue. The posterior being made up of nervous tissue means what about its repair rate? Almost none. Yeah, it's going to be very slow, if at all. So I make that point because it's an interesting point. If someone has a problem with the pituitary gland, which part do you think is probably growing out of control?
Anterior.
Anterior, right. And if they remove the pituitary and they leave any piece of the anterior behind, that's the part that's going to regrow. Posterior, being made up of nervous tissue, probably unlikely to regrow like that anterior would. So, interesting, here we have this type of epithelial tissue secreting hormones in the anterior side. All right. Anterior pituitary hormones generally have an SH or TH as part of their name. And what I mean, SH may mean stimulating hormone, TH may mean tropic hormone. Okay? So when you see SH, it means stimulating hormone. SH means stimulating hormone. TH means tropic hormone. And that's often what we see coming from the anterior pituitary. So SH means stimulating hormone. TH means tropic hormone. So you think, okay, hey, great rule, right? And you look at the list, and first one is growth hormone. It doesn't say stimulating. It doesn't say tropic. But then you've got a few here. You've got thyroid stimulating hormone. There's adrenocorticotropic. There's that portion. Gonadotropins. There's follicle stimulating hormone. So there's a few clues built into these. Unfortunately, this is not an easy list to remember, so this may be a list for a flashcard. You'll want to know these hormones. There's actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 total ones made by the anterior pituitary. So you'll want to be able to say that growth hormone comes from the anterior pituitary, or prolactin, for instance. Okay, so let me explain what a stimulating hormone is and a tropic hormone. What do you think a stimulating hormone tells cells to do? Make something, produce something, okay? So thyroid stimulating hormone, you can probably figure out what its job is. It comes to the thyroid gland and it says what? Make thyroxine. Yeah, it says make something, do something, okay? These tropic ending hormones, tropins are chemicals or hormones that tell another gland or organ to do something. So in fact, the adrenocorticotropic hormone goes to the adrenal gland, to the cortex region, and it says make your hormones. So it tells you exactly what its job is. Yeah, it's coming from the anterior pituitary, telling the adrenal cortex to make its hormones. So there's less memorization work here if you use the clues that are built into the names. Let's do another one. Tropin says, I have a message for you. The message is for the gonads, right? And the message is, hey gonads, make some hormones. Just like ACTH toward the adrenal cortex to make hormones, gonadotropins tell the gonads to make hormones. So a tropin is going to tell another gland or organ to make its hormones. Does this sound like neural stimulation, hormonal, humoral? It's hormonal, right? It's one hormone telling another gland to make or release its hormone. So these two here are great examples of hormonal stimulation. All right. What I've left for you on page 7 is a bunch of instant flashcards. We're going to work through growth hormone, thyroxine, and so forth. Yeah, sure.
Can you clarify the difference between the stimulating hormone and the tropic?
Thyroid stimulating hormone, it comes to the thyroid gland and says make thyroxine. Whereas these hormones here, these tropins, they're about the same type of job. They're going to come to another gland and say make a hormone. It's relatively the same function. It's just that we call some of them tropic hormones and some of them stimulating hormones. So they're all operating under hormonal stimulation.
So we don't really need to know the particulars.
I would not. Yeah, I would just know that when you see stimulating or tropic, it's probably an anterior pituitary.
Tropic and
tropin,
the same thing?
Tropic and tropin, same thing.
Yep.
Okay, so We're going to start off with an anterior pituitary hormone. It is called growth hormone. And growth hormone does exactly what the name implies. It's telling your body cells to grow. Almost every cell has a receptor for growth hormone, and since it's a protein-based hormone, where do you expect to find that receptor? On the outside, right. So most cells of our bodies have a receptor for growth hormone, and you especially see big changes in bones, muscles, skeletal muscles, and your liver. So I don't think we would necessarily tell a skin cell has gotten bigger in size, but we can see dramatic changes when the liver grows, when the bones grow longer, and when your skeletal muscles lengthen. So that's where we see the most dramatic effects of growth hormone. I do want to mention that it increases during our sleep times. So a lot of these hormones have a cycle or rhythm to them. So when parents try to get their kids to go to sleep at night, you know, we may not realize that, hey, there's an underlying reason that you need your sleep, and part of it is to grow and repair those damaged cells. So growth hormone actually peaks during our sleep time. Okay, so let's think about the mechanism to get growth hormone production rolling in the anterior pituitary. So the anterior pituitary doesn't operate by itself. It operates by being told what to do. The hypothalamus will initiate control over the anterior pituitary. Hypothalamus makes this hormone up here. It's GHRH. What does the RH tell you? Yeah, and you know automatically it comes from the hypothalamus, and it's targeting where?
Anterior
pituitary, right. So the hypothalamus initiates control of growth hormone release by making growth hormone releasing hormone. The anterior pituitary in turn releases growth hormone. Growth hormone travels like any other in your bloodstream to target your body cells and makes your body grow. And that doesn't mean just in a child where the body's growing bigger. That means at any time in your life that you need to make and repair cells, you're going to have growth hormone there to help repair those cells. Just to flip ahead for a moment, if you've seen this cell cycle before, those G portions during interphase, those are growth periods. That's when growth hormone will exert its effects on the cell. So interesting that now we can kind of tie in hormonal control of how those cells grow and repair. Okay, so is growth hormone releasing hormone encouraging growth hormone production, or is it stopping it?
Encouraging.
It's encouraging it, good. So if you were to want to stop growth hormone production, should you use this hormone here?
No.
Use which one?
Inhibiting,
yeah, GHIH would be your one of choice, good. I do want to mention that the hormones we're learning oftentimes have as many as 300 different functions. So growth hormone, inhibiting hormone has other names like somatostatin, and it will have other effects on the body in addition to limiting growth hormone production. Thank goodness we're not taking endocrinology. We'd have all these kinds of interactions to learn. So GHIH would in fact shut down this mechanism that we see here. All right, so on your worksheet there, page 7, what role does GHIH play? Good, stops growth hormone, or you could say inhibits growth hormone production. I'm just going to keep a running tab on the board of what we've talked about. So we've now taken care of growth hormone. We know its production is controlled by the hypothalamus. What are the two hormones that control growth hormone release? Releasing and inhibiting, right. And so the catch is they just take GH for growth hormone and tack on the releasing RH or IH as an ending. So makes it pretty easy to follow that way. I just wanted to really quickly run you through some problems with growth hormone. Now I have this stuff let's see. There's actually some blank paper on the bottom right-hand corner of page 7. You may want to take some notes there. I didn't leave room anywhere else for you to jot down info. But these are three growth hormone disorders. They are growth disorders. The first one is gigantism, sometimes called just simply giantism. And so this problem occurs when there's a hypersecretion or too much growth hormone in the childhood growing years. Acromegaly is another condition caused by excess growth hormone or hypersecretion. This, however, occurs during the adult years. And then finally, we have pituitary dwarfism. This is a hyposecretion issue caused during childhood growing years. Okay, so what's the difference between hypersecretion and hypo? Too much, good. And hyposecretion would be, of course, too little. Okay, so let's think big picture here. Could this be the anterior pituitary's entire fault? Because who's controlling the anterior pituitary? Yeah, hypothalamus. So it may in fact be an overgrowth of anterior pituitary tissue. But we also have to say, well, hey, maybe it's the hypothalamus causing too much production. So which hormone might be hypersecreting from the hypothalamus? Yeah, growth hormone releasing hormone may be coming in excess to the anterior pituitary and hypersecreting those hormones. So it's not always a clear-cut picture of simply saying, hey, anterior pituitary is 100% at fault here, when in fact it may be some role contributed to by that hypothalamus. Just want to run you through some pictures of these disorders. Gigantism results from excess growth hormone, and that could actually be genetically driven. It could be hypothalamus, it could be pituitary driven. So the catch is, this type of excess growth must occur during what time of life? Why childhood? That's when you're growing, because around what, age 18 to 21, we start seeing those epiphyseal plates harden and close, and then that's it for that lengthening process. So we expect to see gigantism or giantism to arise during the growing years. People with this condition may exceed, you know, the 7-foot range, they may exceed 8 feet. Throughout history, there have been recordings of people as tall as 11 or 14 feet. And contrary to what we may believe about being a giant, they're not necessarily strong. Their bones and muscles have been stretched long, and unfortunately, that means the rib cage is not able to accommodate the amount of growth that the heart and lungs should have had to keep up with the body size. So you may have a heart built for a 6-foot-tall person that's trying to pump for an 8-foot-tall body. So there's a lot of wear and tear on the body that comes from being a giant. Andre the Giant actually had both gigantism and acromegaly. That means that during his childhood years, he had excess growth hormone. And what happened after he went through puberty? Still had growth hormone. He kept growing. So instead of his bones growing longer, his bones grew appositional wider. Exactly. So that's why his facial features seem enlarged. Acromegaly technically means enlargement of the extremities. And that does include your facial features, hands, and feet. So unfortunately, puberty didn't stop the growth excess for him. It continued on into adulthood. He died in his 60s of heart-related trouble, which is not unusual because people with this condition often have major organs that are not built to survive in a really big body. So unfortunately, that is the demise for some of these people that have this kind of growth condition. A lot of these people have joint issues. They have debilitating joints that just, they can't function under the body's weight and the body's size. This woman died in her 50s. She was around 7'8", if I remember correctly. Yao Ming was a basketball player who, he's still around, of course, but he retired because of, guess what, joint issues. It's a big issue for people with gigantism. This guy, 8'11", was the tallest man in recorded history when he died at age 22. You know, your mom always says, don't pop the blister, right? Blister gets infected. Yeah, and back in this time period, penicillin wasn't really up and running. So we had an infection that went body-wide. He had sepsis, yeah. So unfortunately, he passed away from a blister caused by a leg brace. And again, here we've got, you know, debilitating joint issues. So he had not gone through puberty, which is kind of odd for age 22. Most people have passed through puberty at that point, which means that for him, testosterone would have slowed down those epiphyseal plate growths. So he probably needed some testosterone to stop those epiphyseal plates from growing. They probably didn't fully understand that back then in the 1940s. He was called the Alton Giant. He was built, buried in a concrete vault because people were afraid that he would be dug up and paraded around with the circus, which is in fact how he earned his living back then. He was a giant with the circus. But if you go down to Myrtle Beach and look at the Ripley's, believe it or not, that is him. Yeah, so you don't have to pay to see him. He's right on the street side. I believe it's glassed in. So you can simply just stand at the street and look at the booth where you pay, and he's a wax figure standing there. So he's an interesting case. Here's acromegaly. Enlargement of the hands, enlargement of the extremities. You know, it's not something that you wake up tomorrow and go, you know what, I think I've got acromegaly. What happens is people may see pictures of themselves, or family members may say your physique has changed. It may be something that takes years to recognize. So in this picture, you'll notice the man's features and his face have changed dramatically. The hands have also enlarged. So over the course of years, people may realize there's been some change in my facial features. Sleep apnea, not that everybody with sleep apnea has this condition, but that's a common feature because the facial bones grow. Hands enlarge and feet enlarge. So, you know, people may notice over the course of years that these changes have taken place. Another case of acromegaly, notice the enlarged brow ridge, nose bone, his jaw looks enlarged. Those bones tend to be the ones with the least amount of flesh and tissue covering them, so we tend to see the most bone growth in those areas. Look at the changes to this woman. So, you know, maybe late teens, early 20s, maybe somewhere in her 30s, maybe somewhere in her 50s. So, unfortunately, back in the time period where these photographs were made, there was nothing that could be done about acromegaly. Nowadays, what do you think we could do for a patient with acromegaly?
Give them a growth hormone inhibitor.
Give them an inhibitor, right? Maybe stop the hormone from being released. And if that doesn't work, what's that?
Sex hormones help.
Sex hormones could help you because they could antagonize growth hormone. And if the hormone business doesn't work, you can simply take out
the pituitary.
Yeah, take out that anterior pituitary. On the other end of the spectrum with growth hormone, we have pituitary dwarfism. And I want to make an issue about why we call it pituitary dwarfism, and we just don't simply say it's dwarfism. There's actually over 100 different reasons for dwarfism. Some of it's genetic, some of it's just the way the body grows. So to imply to somebody that we're talking about the pituitary gland, we specifically will say pituitary dwarfism. So in this case, we're looking at hyposecretion of growth hormone. And during what time of life do you think this issue develops?
Childhood.
Childhood, right. So what would you expect to see?
Shortened
body, right? So if you happen to see a child, maybe a five-year-old, who's wearing toddler clothes, looks just like a little toddler, that may be a case of pituitary dwarfism. We can actually test nowadays for it. It's a simple test. And if we find out that a child has, you know, pituitary dwarfism, what can we administer to that child? Growth hormone, good. Now, how long, how many years should you administer growth hormone?
They're going to have to have it.
Until they reach puberty. Yeah, because if we continue administering it after they reach and go through puberty, what can we do? We could go into acromegaly, right. So they can x-ray the hand, for instance, and see if the growth plates are still open. And if they're still growing, then we can continue administering growth hormone. But once those growth plates have closed, we should not administer growth hormone any longer because that could end up being a case of acromegaly. We'll talk about cretinism or congenital hypothyroidism in just a moment. But I did want to point out this. These two people here are pituitary dwarfs. They look like children standing here because their body proportions are like a child's. Their torso's the right size in proportion to their legs and their arms. Compare their bodies to these two. These have adult-sized torsos. Their legs and arms just tend to be shortened. That is genetic. That's right. So that is achondroplasia. If you've ever seen Little People, Big World on TLC, that is what they've got. But this condition here is not necessarily genetic. It's just a pituitary problem. This person here also looks the same in terms of the dwarfs here, but this is a thyroid condition. So yet another reason that a person may have a dwarf-sized body. All right, so how about questions on gigantism, acromegaly, or pituitary dwarfism? Everything making sense so far today? Okay. Just a moment for us to pause and catch our breath. I'll give you a moment to read this question. All right, so what is the best clue in this question? Yeah, working together, same effect. Those are both great clues. What is your answer? A, synergism, good. For this to be permissiveness, what should the question have said?
Allows,
gives permission. One has to happen for another to take effect. Okay, so those are some good clues to look for permissiveness. Okay, and here's another one. Antagonist, okay? So what's your best clue this time in the question?
Opposite.
Opposite, good. All right. Okay, so looks like we're ready to go back to page 7 and hit the middle box at the top on thyroxine. All right, so the control of your metabolism ultimately comes from your hypothalamus. The hypothalamus releases a hormone called TRH. We know that TRH stands for some type of releasing hormone, and the T stands for thyroid releasing hormone. Well, like all releasing hormones that we're going to discuss, what is the target of TRH? Good, anterior pituitary, and of course the anterior pituitary makes a stimulating hormone. That T stands for, once again, thyroid stimulating hormone. And like the name implies, it's going to travel to the thyroid gland. And what's the message for the thyroid gland? Make him release thyroxine. I did want to make a note here that these hormone names and abbreviations up here, I will give them to you both on a test. I'll say thyroid stimulating hormone, and in parentheses, I'll place TSH. I would rather you spend your time learning what the hormones do than having to memorize what the abbreviations are. So I will always give you the full name of the hormone, and then I'll give you the abbreviation. If I don't do that somewhere on the test and you need clarification, absolutely feel free to ask me. That's not the goal of learning about hormones, so I will give you both name and abbreviation. So most of the time, we need to increase thyroxine levels. So the main one we're talking about here is TRH. But in the case that you might need to decrease hormone production by the thyroid, we would invoke which hypothalamus hormone to shut down thyroxine? Inhibiting, right. So we would have to use the inhibiting hormone. Let me ask you this. Let's say that someone has had the pituitary gland removed. Okay, no pituitary gland. Can the hypothalamus and TRH communicate with the thyroid gland? So what happens to thyroxine production?
Doesn't happen,
right. So this case of hormonal control where you've got hypothalamus talking to the anterior pituitary, who then in turn tells the thyroid gland to make hormones, you got to have all three playing the role here. If you take the anterior pituitary out of the mix, you no longer get that communication process. All right, so this is yet another mechanism that is negative in nature. So in excess, you are going to tweak down and shut down production, or if you have too little, you'll ramp up and increase production. All right, so a lot of letters here. First off, where are the adrenal glands? Top of the kidneys, good. The adrenal glands actually have two regions, an outermost portion called the cortex and an innermost portion called the medulla or medulla. Well, this particular chain of events here is only for the cortex or the outermost region. We shorten it and we call it the AC for the adrenal cortex. And that's a good clue because now you see ACTH there. That's, of course, AC, adrenal cortex. Other clues to look for, you've got RH up here coming from the hypothalamus. What kind of hormone is that?
Releasing hormone.
Releasing hormone, good. That C stands for corticotropic releasing hormone. The important part, the C, is the cortex. The cortex of what? Adrenal gland. Yeah, so ultimately, CRH's message will travel to that adrenal gland, but it has to stop off by the anterior pituitary first. ACTH stands for adrenocorticotropic hormone. So it's a type of hormone, it's a stimulating hormone that tells your adrenal gland, the cortex region, to release its hormones. So once again, if someone does not have a functional pituitary gland, is it possible for the hypothalamus to communicate with the adrenal glands?
No,
because we've removed part of that communication mechanism. This is also a negative feedback loop, so if we happen to need more hormones produced by the adrenal glands, then the negative feedback loop comes to the hypothalamus to increase production of CRH, which will in turn tell the pituitary to make more ACTH, or adrenocorticotropic hormone. So now you're getting probably knee-deep in the alphabet soup, right? Okay, so there's a lot of words to keep straight here, a lot of abbreviations to keep straight. Use the clues that are built in, like RH and TH. They're really helpful when you're trying to keep straight where they're coming from and where they're going to be targeting. Good news is, this is not the only time we'll run through these, because when we get to the adrenal glands, we'll come back through the same chart. All right, so here's another set of hormones that work their way through that anterior pituitary. These are called gonadotropic hormones. GN is how we abbreviate them because we want to clarify they're not growth hormones. They're gonadotropic hormones, meaning their ultimate message is for the gonads. So what are gonads? Testes and ovaries, good. So you'll notice that, again, the messages for the gonads starts up here with the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus releases a releasing hormone, no surprise there. Notice its name is G with a little N. That's for gonads. So it's gonadotropic releasing hormone. What do all releasing hormones target? Anterior pituitary. And in turn, the anterior pituitary makes some hormones. These are FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, and LH, which is luteinizing hormone. You oftentimes hear these in conversations for females, especially when you hear about birth control, because a lot of birth control will manipulate FSH and LH levels, but actually they're made in males as well. And ultimately, these target the ovaries and testes and how they regulate hormone production or ovulation in a female or spermatogenesis in a male. We will detail out this last step in the very last class period of this course when we talk about hormone production and regulation of reproduction. Okay, so going back to my little chart where we're keeping track of stuff, which hormone should I place up here for the anterior pituitary?
GnRH.
Does the anterior pituitary make GnRH?
Oh, no, FSH.
Yeah, let's put FSH and LH. Okay, so when we started this conversation, I mentioned that there were six hormones produced by the anterior pituitary. We've gotten, five taken care of so far. All of these hormones produced by the anterior pituitary are ultimately under the control of which brain part?
Hypothalamus.
So all of these that we've discussed so far either have releasing or inhibiting hormones that increase or decrease their production. Okay, so the last one on our list is prolactin. And once again, if you want to increase prolactin production, the hypothalamus has to turn on the mechanism using prolactin-releasing hormone. That targets the anterior pituitary to make him release prolactin, which is PRL up here. What does prolactin tell the mammary glands to do? Make and release milk. So in what population do you think prolactin is in its on mechanism for? Everybody? Just females. And not every female.
The ones that just have babies.
The ones that have babies, right. So the ones that delivered babies and are breastfeeding, producing breast milk, are the only ones that this mechanism should be on for. For everybody else, prolactin inhibiting hormones should actually turn this mechanism off, and that is how it operates in all males and in non-lactating females. So in fact, PIH is the main controller in everybody except for a lactating female. So if we happen to have a male or female who is lactating, no babies have been born, then we've got a couple of places to look. We can look at the breast tissue, right? Okay, that's one place to look. Where are two other places we should look to see what's going on?
Anterior pituitary.
Anterior pituitary.
Hypothalamus.
And the hypothalamus, right. So in lactating males or in lactating females who have not given birth, there's actually three places we should check them out. You know, breast tissue, mammary tissue, anterior pituitary, and the hypothalamus. See which one of those is causing the problem. So back in the day, I'm talking way back in the day, before any of us were ever here, there were people called wet nurses. They were people who, females who fed your babies. And oftentimes they were a mom who had just given birth to a baby, and maybe her baby was weaned and she still produced breast milk. So she could come over and feed your baby if you were unable to do so. So that relied on the continued production of prolactin. And nowadays, wet nurses can come about by women donating their milk to others. But as long as prolactin has been turned on, you can continue producing breast milk pretty much indefinitely as long as there's a source of stimulation, which means that something is suckling from your breast tissue. Once the suckling stops, then wet nursing is kaput. That's no longer. So there's a host of behind-the-scenes hormones that have to be present for wet nursing to begin, and it usually is oxytocin and prolactin working together to bring about milk production. Male lactation, you know, could be a possibility if there's enough stimulation, but we're talking hours of stimulation to turn on milk production. So the reason that male lactation is up here is not because males are breastfeeding babies, but because lactation simply should not be occurring in males, right? Because what hormone keeps prolactin shut off in a male?
PIH.
Yeah, PIH. So we know that if a male is lactating, it could be a condition like gynecomastia where you've got, you know, hormones that are maybe not in tune with one another, or maybe there's cancer of the breast tissue. So just a way to kind of go back and reflect on what we've already discussed, let's talk about this question here. What is the target organ of TSH?
Thyroid.
Thyroid, good. And what does TSH tell the thyroid gland to do?
Thyroxine.
Yeah, release a hormone called thyroxine, good. And going backwards a step up in the chain, what hormone turns on the release of TSH?
TRH.
And that comes from the
hypothalamus,
good. All right, another one here, the target organ of ACTH, adrenal cortex, good. And of course, the job of ACTH is to, yeah, tell the adrenal cortex to release hormones. Take it back up a step. What ultimately tells the pituitary to release ACTH? CRH, good. All right, and here we go with a target organ of prolactin. Mammary glands, good. And of course, we don't necessarily want that turned on in everybody, so what is the target of PIH?
Anterior pituitary.
Yeah, anterior pituitary. So in everybody else who's not breastfeeding or lactating, then PIH shuts off this mechanism for everybody. So it targets the anterior pituitary. So that's the question here. Which hormone is normally in control of prolactin in non-lactating humans?
Hypothalamus,
right? And it is PIH or RH?
IH,
yeah. Keep it shut off. And then in a breastfeeding female, one who's lactating, which hormone can turn on prolactin release?
PRH,
right. So prolactin's kind of an odd one because we don't normally talk about keeping hormones in the off position, but this is one that you keep off unless you need it for lactation. Okay. How about questions on our review questions? Okay. Let me take you on over to page 8.
Is a different beast. Keep in mind, the posterior pituitary doesn't make any hormones. Okay, so that is so important that I'm going to make a note up here. Okay, in fact, the posterior pituitary is a storage bank. And it is storing hormones that are actually made where? Hypothalamus, good. So you may notice the interesting connection between the hypothalamus and the pituitary in this picture. It's not a blood portal system. In fact, what you're seeing are neurons. These neurons travel from the hypothalamus down through the infundibulum, down here into the posterior pituitary, and it's only there that we see a direct supply to the bloodstream. So the hormones that are made up here in the hypothalamus are actually stored in the axon terminals of those neurons down here in the posterior pituitary. And when a nerve impulse travels down the length of these axons and it stimulates those axon terminals, those chemicals being stored there are now released into the bloodstream. And of course, they're called hormones once they're placed into the bloodstream. The two hormones that we're talking about this time are what and what? Oxytocin and ADH. Good. So let's take oxytocin first. You may have heard of this one. It's one of the rare hormones that uses positive feedback for control. This particular hormone is produced by both males and females in the hypothalamus. It is stored in axon terminals of the posterior pituitary until it's ready to be released. And of course, that nerve impulse is what stimulates the release. Now, going back, does this sound like a case of humoral, hormonal, or neural stimulation?
Neural.
Yeah, great case of neural stimulation. When oxytocin travels the bloodstream, it targets a couple of main areas, mammary glands for one. It also targets the uterus for a second one, so it sounds like mostly this is a hormone for females. When it hits the mammary glands, it causes a reflex. Do you recall how reflex is operating? Automatic, right? Involuntary, automatic, predictable responses. So this case, you'll notice the reflex is called the milk letdown, or just simply a milk reflex. So it's kind of like saying, okay, we're ready for milk production to begin. Boom, this reflex is turned on. And so the mammary cells that produce milk, because it can happen like that.
Yeah,
right?
Somebody else's baby cries.
And that's a really good point. If somebody else's baby cries, do you see the neural connection between the cries and this setup?
If they sound like the kid, I have to get the name when I was nursing.
So boom, you're just lactating, yeah. So because it's a neural pathway, you're right, sounds like baby crying can be something that turns on this whole setup here. I do want to mention something interesting. Prolactin actually works in tandem with oxytocin. Oxytocin has to be present to give permission for prolactin to work. So like you said, if you hear a baby cry, that is one of a number of stimuli that can turn on this milk reflex. Baby suckling can be another thing there. So whatever the neural stimulus is that turns on oxytocin release, that turns on this milk reflex. Prolactin then has to be present to continue the milk production. That is for every breastfeeding event. So if you breastfeed every 4 hours, then every time you breastfeed, oxytocin turns on the milk reflex and prolactin maintains milk production. When you stop breastfeeding 4 hours later, same mechanism cuts back oxytocin and prolactin working together. Does that sound like a case of antagonism or synergism?
Synergism.
Yeah, and does it sound like a case of, oh, let's see, permissiveness?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who's giving permission?
Oxytocin.
Oxytocin's giving permission, right. So oxytocin has to be present for prolactin to be able to do its job. So that's one function of oxytocin, is to target those mammary glands. The other function is to target the uterus and cause contractions of the uterus. Females can have a uterine contraction during menstrual cramps, during orgasm, or during childbirth. So no matter what the underlying reason is for it, those uterine contractions are promoted by oxytocin. So we know that during childbirth, when a baby's head pushes against the cervix, the feedback mechanism is positive in nature, goes back to the brain and says to the hypothalamus, release more oxytocin. So that mechanism continues until childbirth is accomplished. Okay, so what are the two target organs of oxytocin? Tells the uterus to do what?
Contract.
And we're going to say that we're going to tell the mammary glands to let down milk. Basically, it's turning on that reflex that then allows breastfeeding or lactation to occur. Stuff to learn though about oxytocin. If we had more time, we could talk about all the other effects of it. It is known as the feel-good hormone. It is a hormone that allows people to feel like they're bonded to somebody else. You know, I don't know how many of you have given birth or been around somebody who's had a baby, but after birth, you know, no woman feels like getting up and raising a child that very day, right? You're so exhausted after having gone through childbirth that really, this has to be a hormonally driven process to make the mom want to take care of that baby. So there's oxytocin flowing through her body. It makes her bond to that child and want to take care of that child, even if she's just dead tired, exhausted, and can't lift a finger. So they say that oxytocin, they suspect it's the reason that mama bird takes care of baby bird. You know, why else would you go and give half your food away, right? So there's got to be some kind of hormonal mechanism here that's driving this nurturing need to take care of something else, and it's quite likely this hormone. This hormone can be given in a nasal spray, which is really interesting. It does not cross the blood-brain barrier. So if you're doing a nasal spray, good luck getting it to your brain, right? But they suspect that if you are able to get this hormone across the blood-brain barrier, that you feel good. You feel like you're in love. You know,
snuggly.
What's that?
Snuggly.
Snuggly, everything's great. So, you know, I think they should pipe this stuff in. If we can figure out a way to cross the blood-brain barrier to all these places where we get, you know, like airports, right? Yeah. So, interesting things could be down the road for that hormone. It is more than just a female hormone. It does seem to have effects in any human body, whether male or female. All right. I want to introduce to you one of your best friends for the semester. This is anti-diuretic hormone, or ADH for short. We will talk about it almost every other week in this class. Okay, so new best friend for you. First, where is it made?
Hypothalamus.
It is stored until needed in the
posterior
pituitary. Good. And look at its name. Its name is against diuresis. Diuresis is what?
Urination.
So this is the hold your pee hormone, hold your urine hormone, keep your water hormone. In other words,
floating hormone.
bloating hormone. Yeah, keep you from getting dehydrated
retaining
hormone.
Retaining water.
What's that?
Retaining water.
Retaining water. Good. So all of these things are ways to think of ADH. It prevents you from producing urine. It prevents you from, you know, losing water. It prevents you from being dehydrated. You think, oh, how awful this sounds, but no, it's really a good thing, because you don't want to be like, you know, sipping water 24/7 just to stay hydrated. This hormone makes sure that what you drink, you use efficiently, and you only get rid of what you don't need. So this is a good hormone to prevent you from having to drink constantly. As it is, you take in about 2 liters of fluid a day between the foods that you eat and what you drink. You would hate to have to take in 10 liters a day if this hormone wasn't working around. So it's a very beneficial hormone in that aspect. Okay, so what does ADH target?
Kidneys.
Now, where is it made? And stored in the? Right, and then released when you need it to the kidneys. And notice there's another effect here. It produces a vasoconstricting effect on our blood vessels. What does that mean is happening?
The blood vessels tighten.
They tighten, good, they squeeze. So ADH will promote blood vessel constriction. What do you think happens to your blood pressure when you squeeze vessels?
Goes up,
right. Likewise, it has a dual or a double effect. If you're squeezing vessels, you're going to increase your pressure. And if you're retaining water, that also will increase your blood pressure. And, you know, you think about high blood pressure and that's a bad thing. This is just trying to maintain your blood pressure. It's not trying to give you high blood pressure. It's just trying to make sure you have normal blood pressure. Okay, so let's go back to our chart here. What does ADH target?
Keeps.
Good. And what message does it have for the kidneys?
Save water.
Yep, save water. Okay, so ADH is very important for hydration. It's very important for maintaining blood pressure. It is a vasoconstrictor. That's a term we'll definitely revisit with more as we go on. So have you ever had a bag of salty foods, maybe salty chips, salty peanuts, maybe didn't have enough to drink with it, and then maybe 30 minutes or an hour later, you can't drink enough? Okay, so what happened when you had that bag of salty chips? What happened to your bloodstream?
Too much salt.
Too much salt, right. So what's happening is, if we go back and look at your hypothalamus, there are receptors here that detect how salty your bloodstream is. Oh boy, this sounds familiar, right? Mm-hmm. What happens to water when there's too much salt?
Water
follows the salt, and of course you retain more water when you're too salty. There's another mechanism that cuts on to make you drink more, so you'll also be more thirsty when you're too salty. So then, in fact, the effects of ADH are to cut on a thirst mechanism and also to make sure that you retain as much water when you're too salty. Last question at the bottom down here. What effect does alcohol have on anti-diuretic hormone production?
Turns
it off. So alcohol shuts off the mechanism of releasing ADH, and if you don't release enough ADH, what happens to the water flowing through your kidneys?
It just keeps going.
It keeps going, so you pee, right? So, yeah, you get dehydrated. So that's exactly what happens when people drink alcohol, especially in excess. It promotes a shut off of the ADH process. And when you shut down ADH, you urinate frequently.
So it's doing the opposite, so your blood alcohol level's high. So it's not working the same as like salt.
Right, because that osmoreceptor in the hypothalamus is not looking for alcohol concentration, it's just looking for salt concentration. So if you're dehydrated, it could actually make you
worse.
Worse, yeah.
Okay, so let's see how far we've made it in the horse pack. I need to talk to you about diabetes insipidus. Why don't we save diabetes insipidus for Thursday, and then we'll keep trucking with thyroid gland in class on Thursday.